From HowStuffWorks.com, this is The Stuff of Life.
Welcome to The Stuff of Life. I'm your host, Julie Douglas. Imagine yourself as a newly hatched cicada living deep in the soil. In the vast crisscrossing tree roots, you drain the network of tree sap until you become plumper and plumper. And each year that passes, there's a mounting sense that one day the temperature will be just so, and you will know it's time to dig your way to the surface. For 17 years, you toil under the earth for one reason and one reason only: to come to the surface and mate. To find the one who will respond to your finely tuned notes, the one who will make her way through a thicket of 1,000 other songs to you and only you. In this episode, we turn to nature, to the songs that are all around us. We take a trip to Fernbank Museum in Atlanta, Georgia for the exhibit Wild Music, and we eavesdrop on humans and animals in communication.
The Thai Elephant Orchestra, to me, is a perfect example of non-music being billed as music.
And we talked to John P. Swaddle about his study on the eastern bluebird, its birdsong increasingly smothered by noise pollution.
I try to see the world as much as I can through the senses of the animals that I study, and that's largely birds. So I think about, well, how are the birds being affected by this at this time?
But first, human birdsong. That's Rue's song from the movie The Hunger Games, a four-note tune at times signaling goodbye to loved ones and at others showing support for the revolution. But this is a fictional whistle. On the coast of Turkey in the small mountain village of Kaskoy, people use bird-like whistles to communicate across steep hills. The following whistle conversation is addressed to a man named Jakob, and it's about how his tea is ready and his sister will be home soon. He replies that he's cutting hay and will be there in a moment. Amazingly, these whistles, sprinkled among similar-sounding bird calls, allow for nuanced information to be transmitted. It's pure biomimicry, humans impersonating nature. And while we move further and further away from nature as a model to emulate, we can find its auditory influence everywhere, even in horror movies. Daniel Bloomstein, an expert in animal distress calls, made this connection in his 2012 study, finding that nonlinear sounds like the blown-out vocalizations of an animal scream elicit a biologically ingrained response to them from us, and that horror movies often weave animal screams into their soundtracks. That's the distress call of the baby marmoset, a large ground squirrel. It shares a similarity with an iconic moment in a certain movie. These are manic pieces of noise, effective tools for manipulating our fear at a primal level, raising the hackles of our alarm systems. That we're deeply rooted, symbolically and otherwise, with the sounds of nature is also evident in the exhibit Wild Music. At Fernbank Museum, when you enter the Wild Music exhibit, you're met with a siren call from the ocean. That's the minke whale. We used to think of the ocean as containing vast silence, but underwater microphones called hydrophones have revealed a world of sound. Snapping shrimp, farting fish, underwater earthquakes, and of course, otherworldly whale songs. But that we identify these tones as songs in the first place is a thorny issue, as the exhibit explores through three different perspectives. The first is from Steve Nowicki, the Dean of Natural Sciences at Duke University and a longtime student of birdsong.
I think the question, what is music, is something that we all have to answer for ourselves. Because the word music is referring to an aesthetic ideal. Some of us might define that quite narrowly. If we were interested only in, say, classical music, then we'd throw out Stravinsky and certainly John Cage, modern rap, and a whole bunch of other popular music. Others of us would define music as anything that triggers our own personal aesthetic response. I listen to bird songs a lot, and I consider that a kind of natural music or a wild music. I'm willing to put the word wild or natural in front of that because I understand that musicians would maybe take exception to broadening it that much. But when I'm out in a marsh at dawn and the sun is just rising, the world around me is filled with a symphony of sounds.
In that marsh, Nowicki is picking out a melody, and in that melody, emotion.
It all comes together for me in a very aesthetically overwhelming package, and I consider that a kind of natural music. It gives me a kind of emotional response that is in the same vein as the response I might get from listening to Beethoven's Ode for Joy.
Nowicki also points out that while most people would consider birdsong as musical, not all would say that it is actually music, something musicologist Elizabeth Tolbert of Johns Hopkins University isolates in the Thai Elephant Orchestra.
The elephants have been trained to play, I guess, or at least make sounds with Thai traditional instruments. And when you hear it, not knowing that it's elephants making the music, it sounds one way. And when you hear it knowing that it is elephants making this music, it sounds another way. And I think that when you hear it within the expectation of it being music, in a way it is music at that point, because a human has recorded it and presented it as music. But if you think of it in terms of what the elephants are trying to do, it's not music in that sense. And I think this shows you how impossible it is to hear a sound just as pure sound. There's always some sort of interpretation going on in the background.
Chuna McIntyre, a Central Yupik Eskimo artist, echoes this idea that it comes down to us as the interpreters.
Music is a search. In my estimation, what we're trying to say is it's the search for emotion. That's why from ancient times we call it yorun, the reason for looking or searching. Atuk is the act of singing it. Atuk essentially means you don on your search, your music, you put it on, almost like a piece of clothing.
So do animals truly make music? For Tolbert, it's not likely.
These sounds can be interpreted as if they were made by people or made by some kind of supernatural beings that have human-like intentions and thoughts. But we shouldn't attribute that kind of thought process to a bird that is making these sounds.
But for McIntyre, animal song and our interpretation of it are one and the same.
Well, take the raven. The raven is one of our most important birds in our ancient and even today's mythology. And we sing his songs, songs that are born of him, we vocalize. And we sing so other humans can understand what he is singing about. Shikinta, ah, ah, shikinta, ah, ah, shikin, shikin, chitik. That's one of the little ditties that we sing of the raven when he's jumping about and, you know, just being sure of himself and picking little leaves or grass from the ground. When animals sing, they aspire through our abilities to interpret music, song, or dance. In essence, they sing through us. We become the interpreters. We become the vehicle of these aspirations. for the animal kingdom. It's almost like we're doing this in concert together. And after all, we all exist in the universe together.
It's impossible to know if animals have the same kind of search for emotional meaning in song that we do, but it is possible to demonstrate that they have a very visceral response to these melodies.
You can show that a female bird's reproductive system will change when she hears a male bird's song. It actually stimulates her reproductive system. It changes her hormonal profile and will lead her to become more likely to build a nest and lay eggs and so forth. You can show that a male song sparrow, for example, that hears another song sparrow's song will within a few minutes have a higher level of testosterone in its bloodstream and will become correspondingly more aggressive. So those are different kinds of responses than the responses that I would feel, say, to a Beethoven symphony. I mean, I hope my testosterone level doesn't rise in response to, say, a rousing scherzo.
These discussions about music and animals and the way we view them matter, because behind these songs are warnings, invitations, the buzzing of life. But this buzzing, this background to our city parks, our streets, and our backyards, is changing.
We're seeing extinctions accelerate at a very rapid pace, and geologists are telling us that the rate of extinction currently is perhaps even outside the rate of any mass extinction event the planet's ever experienced. What people are going to experience in terms of their own sort of connections with nature are going to be fundamentally different than when I was a kid.
That's John P. Swaddle, a professor at the College of William and Mary, a biologist who studies bird communication.
I was one of those kids who, from a very young age, actually knew what they wanted to do. Even as a 6, 7, 8-year-old, I was fascinated by animals.
On his way to elementary school, Swaddle would pass by the house of Sir David Attenborough.
He was one of my heroes just from a very young age, and I grew up watching his programs all the time. And I just became fascinated by what animals do.
To persuade females to come close and admire his plumes, he sings the most complex song he can manage. And he does that by copying the songs of all the other birds he hears around him, such as the kookaburra.
Birds aren't just sensitive to the noises around them, but to the changing conditions as well. So much so that we have the term canary in a coal mine to describe their ability to suss out danger before humans do.
Birds are certainly sentinels for a lot of ecological change because birds are very dynamic within a lot of ecosystems. They are both prey and predators within a lot of ecosystems. And so if something happens within that environment, birds are often a fairly sensitive indicator of something going wrong. And we've seen shifts in bird populations substantially just in the last couple of decades.
There have been studies about birds altering the way they sing relative to their environment. For instance, birds in the cities sing differently than birds in the country because of background noise. But Swaddle and his colleagues wanted to know how this was affecting the birds' behaviors. And they did this by studying eastern bluebirds and exposing them to different noise levels. Not only did they find that the birds could deftly adjust their songs, but in some instances, the birds had to shout to be heard.
Birds can change the way they sing very quickly and very dynamically. So really just as humans do, if you find yourself in a noisy situation, you start shouting. But as you shout, the pitch of your voice also goes up. And that's exactly what bluebirds do as well.
In the study, the implications of sound pollution are starkly evident.
In the noisiest situations among the birds that we studied, the birds who were trying to breed in the noisiest conditions had far fewer babies than the birds that were breeding in the quieter conditions, even though they were changing their songs. So that comes at a cost. They're producing fewer babies, and so there would be a fitness deficit for living in those noisiest conditions.
Okay, to bring it down to human terms, imagine trying to settle down and have a family all in one night at a loud bar where you're trying to shout over the music to make a connection. While we humans can leave the bar and seek the refuge of our apartments, bird habitats are the bar. There's no escaping the thumping noise. And it's worth noting that in this study, Swaddle and his colleagues weren't even exposing the birds to the worst of noise pollution.
The noises that we recorded here in the context of what the bluebirds had to sing over were nowhere near as loud as construction or a chainsaw. This is largely road traffic and, you know, a fair distance from the roads too as well. So this is more akin to, say, the sound of a washing machine while you're in the room next door or something like that. It's not a really loud song. Perhaps it's like the sound, the kind of noise that you might experience if someone has the TV on and you're trying to have a conversation.
Okay, so the bird population decreases. What's the harm?
Because the birds are connected to what eats them and what they eat, and they also disperse seeds, it also changes lots of other parts of the ecosystem as well, to the point of it even changes the plants that are in the area, because the birds interact with the plants either by spreading their seeds or by eating things that eat the plants, and so on. So the effects of noise on conservation biology are really quite profound and quite unexpected to most people who just think it might be a nuisance, but it's really detrimentally affecting lots of different types of organisms.
Swaddle's study, which is just a sliver of an example of all the ways human activity is altering nature, demonstrates something called the cascade effect. The reduction of one species can have dreadful effects that spiral out and affect other animals and even the landscape itself.
These animals and biodiversity is important to us as a society, and we're actually losing something substantial by losing biodiversity. And that's another part of this whole argument about why people should be more concerned about nature, more connected to nature.
Nature gave us the first songs, the patterns and melodies that we replicate in instruments and our own voices, the first songs that transcended the limits of a spoken word language, giving us the ability to communicate powerful emotions immediately, the first songs that gave people a sense of unity, and the first songs we used as a basis for our own ritual and social behaviors, including courtship. The question is whether these first songs will persist, or whether they'll continue to recede into the background of our own noise. Thank you to Fernbeck Museum, which is currently exhibiting Wild Music. Wild Music is a production of the Association of Science Technology Centers, the Science Museum of Minnesota, and the University of North Carolina at Greensboro School of Music, with major funding from the National Science Foundation and additional support from the Harman International NEC Foundation of America. Thank you to John Swaddle for talking to us about his work with Eastern Bluebirds. The Stuff of Life is written and co-produced by me, Julie Douglas. Original music and sound design is by co-producer Noel Brown. Editorial oversight is provided by head of production Jerry Rowland. In the next episode, which wraps up season one of The Stuff of Life, we look at how life is just a game.
Gets down to defining who you are, right? And like gamification gives you metrics to help you to define who you are. And we like to think that based on merit, that's how we accelerate and level up.
If you like what we do here, visit us on Facebook and Twitter. In the meantime, email us your season two episode suggestions at thestuffoflife@howstuffworks.com.